Good evening for WBAI News in New York. I'm Linda Perry. Oscar Morrell, he's a 35-year-old porter at the New School. He has been charged with murder in the deaths of Imam Akanji and Tara Uden near their mosque in Ozone Park, Queens. The NYPD found a handgun stashed in the wall of Morrell's apartment. Queens DA Richard Brown said the killings are being viewed as a possible hate crime. New York City's public advocate Tish James says we need to have more facts in the case and that our thoughts should be on the families.
Two, I'm making sure that the Muslim community is safe, that all mosques are protected, that they have protection, and that we talk about love as opposed to hate, and that we bring people together, and that all of us stand together against Donald Trump, who is basically trying to divide us as a country. And I think that's really should be our focus. But it's really critically important that so many elected officials, including the mayor of the city of New York, went to this funeral for this imam and his assistant. That was important to let the Muslim community know that they are not a marginalized community, that they are part. They are Americans, and they are part of New York City, and they need support like any other group in this city.
And they felt it was important to announce their demands.
And it was really critically important that they support, and we support their, that we look at their demands, and that we support their demands. And their demands were, some of them were rather reasonable, including but not limited to making sure that they have security at their mosque. And I think that's a reasonable demand.
James says the city should work on this as it moves forward with the city budget. New York City Council Speaker Mark Viverito addressed the pain of the Bangladeshi community today at City Hall.
We have heard, right, that someone has been apprehended. And so I want to thank the NYPD for their swiftness in really getting at the heart of this and having someone now in custody. But let's be very clear. I mean, a community is in grief. A community that has seen a rise in the level of attacks and crimes committed against them. So the level of anxiety and fear is real, and we can't dismiss that. Whether or not statements have been made which are correct, incorrect, I think we have to get at the heart of what the sentiment is. There is a sense of fear. We reject anything. I personally do, I know my colleagues do. Any action that is taken against someone based on their religion and based on who they are. We are a city that is inclusive and embraces that diversity. So I recognize the pain that this community is going through. We've done a lot of work with our diverse communities in the city of New York, and we have a great track record of implementing policies that really demonstrate that. But we have to really try to set that outside and try to get at the be empathetic and be understanding of what it is that we're going through. So obviously the NYPD is in the initial stages of its investigation. They're not closing the door. They're saying obviously everything's on the table in terms of looking at motivations. So if it is determined, and if it is determined that it is a hate crime, they will act accordingly. And the full measure of the law will weigh heavily against this individual.
In other New York City news, the family of 28-year-old Akai Gurley received a $4.1 million settlement in the wrongful death lawsuit. It was filed by Akai Gurley's family. The city is paying $4.1 million, and the New York City Housing Authority is contributing $400,000 to settle the suit. Gurley was killed by rookie cop Peter Liang. He was doing vertical patrol with his gun drawn in a public housing staircase. Liang was found guilty of manslaughter in February. He was fired from the NYPD. A judge later reduced that conviction. Liang was sentenced to 5 years probation and 800 hours of community service. While Akai Gurley's family received some justice, Gurley's little girl will no longer see her dad. And while many have said no amount of money can make up for a loss of life at the hands of police, the city's law department today called the settlement a fair resolution of a tragic matter. In other news, in New York City, officials say 49 pregnant women have tested positive for Zika. This since April. One baby has been born with microcephaly due to the mosquito-borne virus. Overall, more than 3,400 at-risk pregnant women have been tested under the city's Zika action plan. Officials say most people who tested positive were infected while traveling to Zika-affected areas, with a small minority getting it via sexual transmission. Today, Mayor de Blasio said the city has committed $21 million to protect New Yorkers from Zika. He and other politicians, including Representative Carolyn Maloney, called on Congress to approve the $1.9 billion in emergency Zika funding. Federal health officials say there have been 420 Zika cases in New York City. And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. Environmental advocates rallied with city council members today to push for a bill which bans fracking and oil waste from New York City water and New York City streets. The bill is sponsored by council members Costa Costantinatis and Steve Levin. Looking at the activists behind him on the steps of City Hall, council member Levin says we need to keep our water clean.
We all rely on water to survive, and we have the best water in the entire country here in New York City. And that's because of our amazing system of aqueducts, viaducts, and reservoirs that we have here in New York. It is our lifeblood. It is our city's greatest treasure. And the reason why it is so protected is because of all of you. So I thank you.
Thank you.
According to Levin, the bill is the first in the country.
The first municipal legislation nationally that comprehensively bans the use of discharge of oil and natural gas waste products, including hydrofracking. So not only does this include hydrofracking, but all natural gas and oil production. These waste products pose significant dangers to public health and to our environment because they contain naturally occurring pollutants and chemical additives used in hydrofracking. And we all know that what's used in hydrofracking, we don't even know the tip of the iceberg, folks. We know that we don't know, but we know it's dangerous.
Ellen Weiniger is with Grassroots Environmental Education. She says toxic and radioactive fracking waste byproducts and their disposal and application could result in irreversible damage. It could place significant health and financial burdens on the public.
The science says that radioactive materials should never be released in an uncontrolled manner.
Why?
Radioactive materials can become bioaccumulate over time, delivering a dangerous dose of radiation to millions of people over time. Radioactive materials and the toxic chemicals can persist, and particularly radioactive materials can persist for thousands of years and are linked to bone, liver, and breast cancers. They can become airborne, and as trucks and passenger vehicles travel along roads that could, where leaks could have occurred, spills, or applications, and therefore can be tracked on tires and on pedestrian shoes and tracked indoors and linger for thousands of years. Rain and ice melt carry these contaminants and can run off of surfaces, road surfaces, and end up in our water, groundwater and surface water supplies.
And the threat from hydrofracking has not passed, says Councilmember Costantinatis.
The courts have used the 2005 Energy Policy Act as a shield for big oil companies to continue withhold from the public many of the chemicals that are used in fracking. This waste can be potentially hazardous and disposed of in wastewater treatment plants and running off into natural bodies of water. This is made worse by municipalities that have been using frack waste on their roads as de-icer. New York, yeah, boo. Intro 446A will protect New York City from such activities. This bill will prohibit the discharge of any oil or natural gas waste into any surface bodies of water located in the city or any wastewater treatment plants. It will also make sure that we will never be able to use, no matter who the mayor is, no matter who the city council is, from this point forward, frack waste will not be able to come into New York City. So today is a great day in the fight for protect our environment, a great day to continue to stand up against fracking.
For 50 years, Riverkeeper has been working as the watchdog of New York State and New York City's drinking water, surface water, and all of our green spaces in the city of New York.
Sean Dixon is a staff attorney at Riverkeeper.
I'm very glad that we can be here today to keep these toxins out of our parks, keep our landfills as clean as we can get them to be, make sure that our roads aren't applied with all this horribleness that comes from an industry that doesn't have to deal with all of the problems that it generates. So we're going to hold the line here, and I really believe that an informed democracy at the local level can lead to these changes that will trickle throughout the country that will hopefully make this industry aware of the fact that it has downsides, it has things that will affect our public health and our environment, and we won't let that stand. So I'm very glad to be here in New York City, where we're making this stand begin. Thank you.
Thank you, Sean.
And in other environmental news, there are groups who are opposing the Hudson Barge Anchorage proposal. Environmental groups and public officials don't want 10 new anchorage sites for commercial vessels along the Hudson River. Andrea Sears reports.
The plan would create berths for up to 43 ships and barges between Yonkers and Ulster County. Andy Bicking with the group Scenic Hudson says not only would the plan turn reclaimed waterfront into industrial areas, the anchorages would affect wildlife habitat and potentially threaten air and water quality.
Many of the barges are carrying highly volatile oil from the Bakken oil fields in North Dakota, and the risk of a spill, of course, would be disastrous to the region.
Shipping companies say barges have been using the anchorage sites for years to avoid hazards like fog and ice on the river. The Coast Guard has ordered shipping companies not to anchor in any undesignated locations except in special circumstances. Bicking acknowledges that there are safety concerns, but believes creating new anchorage sites could have other consequences.
The concern that we have is not use of these facilities, but what it would mean to stockpile barges so that they could maximize use of these facilities in the future.
And he points out that the barges and the oil they carry support very few jobs in New York State, while the risks fall on local communities. The public has been following the proposal closely, and the Coast Guard is considering holding public hearings. Bicking adds many elected officials are raising concerns as well.
Mayors, county executives, Senators Gillibrand and Schumer have all expressed alarm about the proposal and have called for the public hearings and, in some cases, a full environmental review.
The Coast Guard is accepting public comments on the proposal through September 7th. For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
And you're listening to the news on WBAI in New York. At City Hall today, new legislation gives veterans and military personnel protected class status, this under New York City's human rights law. Councilmember Jemani Williams, along with New York City public advocate Tish James, introduced the bill which protects vets against discrimination.
This legislation will designate veterans as a protected class and any form of discrimination against them. Because they are veterans, will be illegal under the human rights law. This means that unscrupulous housing lending and real estate practices that target or discriminate against veterans will not be tolerated. They will be prohibited and punishable under the law. Landlords will not be able to deny veterans housing simply because they are veterans, and financial institutions that deny veterans equal access to loans and credit will be held accountable, and they too will be accountable under the law. And no employer will be able to refuse to hire a veteran because of their veteran status. Now you may ask, does this really happen? Yes. The Office of Public Advocate has received a number of complaints, and that's why we've partnered with Councilmember Williams to introduce this legislation.
Nearly 900,000 veterans live in New York State, 225,000 in New York City. Statewide, there are 30,000 active duty military personnel and 30,000 National Guard and Reserve personnel. And within these numbers, there are vets who face discrimination.
It's a great thing to hear our fellow citizens say, we support our troops and we love our veterans. But too often when it comes to hiring a new employee or finding a new tenant, employers and landlords may assume that veterans and military members are either a risk or a problem.
Kristen Rouse is the founding director of the New York City Veterans Alliance. She served in the U.S. Army and in the New York State National Guard. Rouse did three tours of duty in Afghanistan, the last two times when her National Guard units were called up for active duty. Rouse stands on the steps of City Hall praising the new legislation, pointing out obstacles vets encounter.
Veterans of any service era may be seen as too physically or psychologically damaged to be worthy of reasonable accommodation or understanding. Landlords may not understand or accept VA disability, pension, or GI Bill payments as legitimate income. Military reservists and National Guard members may be seen as risky employees because of their scheduled monthly and annual training. or because they may be called up for a period of weeks or months to serve in our nation's defense.
We speak a lot, very highly of our veterans, but are we doing what we're supposed to be doing for them?
New York City Council Member Jamani Williams.
By putting this in the human rights law, we've made it much easier to bring a complaint to a commissioner who was really taking this HRC, the Human Rights Commission, to a next level. And I want to say thank you so much. It used to be a place where people thought their complaints went and just stayed there. And she's really made it a place where you can come and really have action. And she's openly supported making the commission more robust, adding more protections. So people now don't have to worry about going to court. They can go to the Human Rights Commission, they can file a complaint, and violators can be fined. It's very important. Our bill actually also extends the people who are currently protected under federal law. We now include reservists and state retired veterans who were not fully protected. So this bill is very important. We should all be proud. And I think this is a case of us trying to put our money where our mouth is.
Commissioner of Veterans Services, retired Brigadier General Dr. Lori Sutton, says this bill is a convergence of city stakeholders working together.
Here in New York City, we're reminded every day of how veterans and their families are our city's leading natural renewable resource. And what is that renewable resource? It's the commitment to and the capacity for service. That's our North Star. And what this legislation will now do is for veterans who have faced discrimination, whether it be in education, whether it be in employment, whether it be in housing. You know, it's nice to know that the feds got your back, but D.C.'s a long ways away, and Albany's a long ways away. And thanks to this legislation, it's no more than one's own city.
You're listening to the news here on WBAI in New York. Other problems the City Council seeks to address are needs of unpaid caregivers. This with a package of legislation which surveys their needs and delivers a plan to help the caregivers. In New York City alone, there are about 1.3 million unpaid caregivers. Councilmember Margaret Chin.
I know that I wouldn't be here today without my family's help to take care of my son in the early stage of my career. It is time that these New Yorkers get the support they deserve. Unpaid caregivers provide compassionate and often complex care for people with Alzheimer's, with disability, or other intensive medical conditions. Our healthcare system would be quickly overwhelmed without the care that they provide. Intro 1081A will require the city to survey unpaid caregivers to find out what support they need. The city will then able to formulate plan to further support these caregivers. Unpaid caregivers need emotional and financial support. They need to know that they are not alone.
Along with Councilmember Chin, Councilmember Debbie Rose sponsored the unpaid caregiver legislation. She says from statistics and personal experience, she knows that more and more New Yorkers are caring for children and elderly parents while juggling professional and other responsibilities.
This issue looms large in the city's future. The majority of parents, including mothers of young children, are in the workforce. The population of disabled elderly adults is projected to grow significantly in the next 20 years, and the responsibility for their care will fall on working family members. That is why I sponsored the Caregiver Discrimination Act signed into law in January, which prohibits employment discrimination based on an individual's actual or perceived status as a caregiver. That legislation was an important first step in addressing the needs of caregivers. Today, we take the next important step. Today's bill, which calls on the city to develop a comprehensive plan to address the needs of informal caregivers, will help address the needs of tens of thousands of unpaid caregivers in New York City.
And the New York City Council has been working on criminal justice reform. New legislation will establish what's called a Division of Transitional Services. The aim is to improve social and health services for those who have been released from prison. Speaker Mark Vivedito.
The majority of individuals released from city jails leave without a discharge plan or access to services that would assist them to re-enter into the community after a period of incarceration. The division would be headed by a coordinator who is charged with creating a coordinated system of reentry services, including access to housing, job training, and public benefits.
When one speaks with formerly incarcerated individuals, often they are at a loss as to how they can go on, what they should do, where they should go. The intent of this legislation is to create an agency which will help them rebuild their lives, contribute to the community, and prevent recidivism. In other news, a Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit is suing the U.S. government. It is challenging its authority to provide Israel with foreign aid. WBAI's Rebecca Miles has more.
The director of the Institute for Research Middle East Policy filed the lawsuit in D.C. Federal District Court on August the 8th, arguing that the U.S. government is violating its own laws by giving foreign aid to Israel. The lawsuit names President Barack Obama, the CIA director, and secretaries of Commerce, Defense, Energy, State, and Treasury as defendants. The suit challenges the authority of the president and federal agencies to give aid to a country that is a non-signer to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and has an alleged nuclear weapons program. The lawsuit argues in the mid-1970s, during investigations into illegal diversion of weapon-grade uranium from a U.S. contractor to Israel, Senators Stuart Stymington and John Glenn amended the 1961 Foreign Assistance Act to ban any aid to clandestine nuclear powers that are not NPT signers. Israel has never officially admitted to having a nuclear weapons program. Instead, has repeated over the years that it would not be the first country to introduce nuclear weapons to the Middle East. However, it's widely believed to possess nuclear weapons and to be the sixth country in the world to have developed them, allegedly having built its first nuclear weapon in December 1966. It is also known as one of the four nuclear-armed countries not recognized as a nuclear weapons state by the NPT, the others being India, Pakistan, and North Korea. The timing of the complaint comes as the Obama administration and Israeli government are negotiating a new 10-year memorandum of understanding to provide foreign aid of $4 to $5 billion annually. The complaint points out that in 2008, former President Jimmy Carter told reporters that Israel had more than 150 nuclear weapons. In 2002, according to the complaint, the Department of Energy under the Department of State passed the Guidance on Release of Information Relating to the Potential for an Israeli Nuclear Capability. That guidance, the complaint said, meant that the State Department or Department of Energy unlawfully conspired to codify nuclear ambiguity through a new secret gag law targeting any U.S. federal government employee or contractor from publicly communicating about Israel's nuclear weapons program under threat of immediate employment loss, fines, and imprisonment. The complaint gives as an example of the effect of the gag the saga of Los Alamos National Laboratory nuclear analyst James Doyle, who wrote candidly about Israel's nuclear weapons program for a magazine in 2013. After a congressional staffer read the article, which had passed a classification review, it was referred to classification for a second review. Doyle's pay was then cut, his home computer searched, and he was fired, according to the complaint. Rebecca Miles, WBAI News, New York.
In other news, a federal audit says New York State's Governor Andrew Cuomo's administration mismanaged $22 million spent to promote tourism in areas affected by three damaging storms. The report from the Department of Housing and Urban Development's Office of Inspector General says New York officials failed to comply with procurement rules, that they did not ensure money was spent effectively. The audit says the failures amount to a significant deficiency. The audit is the third this summer to fault economic development programs run by Governor Cuomo's administration. And New York State Attorney General Schneiderman has secured a restraining order and announced a lawsuit against a New York-based company for allegedly selling K2 online. Attorney General Schneiderman says Queens-based LegalHerbalBud.com sells hallucinogens similar to synthetic marijuana or K2. Schneiderman says an uptick in synthetic marijuana consumption and dramatic rise in New York City emergency room visits last month shows that it's a serious problem. The lawsuit alleges the company's products are mislabeled, that they fail to list ingredients as required by New York law. A judge issued a court order temporarily blocking sales. And finally, it was Fidel Castro's birthday over the weekend. The leader thanked Cubans for their well wishes on his 90th birthday. He criticized President Barack Obama in a lengthy letter published in state media. He wrote about his birthday on Saturday, saying, "Modern medical techniques have allowed me to scrutinize the universe." Castro stepped down as Cuba's president 10 years ago after suffering a severe gastrointestinal illness. Just after 6 p.m., he could be seen in footage on state television slowly approaching his seat at Havana's Karl Marx Theater, clad in a white Puma tracksuit top and green shirt. He sat in what appeared to be a specially equipped wheelchair, and he watched a musical tribute by H. Children's Theater Company, accompanied by footage of highlights from his decades in power. He sat alongside his younger brother, President Raul Castro, and President Nicolas Maduro of Venezuela, along with Cuba's highest-ranking military and civilian officials. In his letter, Castro accompanied his thanks and reminiscences about his childhood and youth in eastern Cuba, describing the geology and the plant life of the region where he grew up. He touched on his father's death shortly before his own victory in overthrowing Batista in 1959. In his letter criticizing Obama, who appeared to anger the revolutionary leader with a March trip to Cuba in which he called for Cubans to look forward towards the future. A week after the trip, Castro wrote a sternly worded letter admonishing Obama to read up on Cuban history, and he declared that we don't need the empire to give us anything. In Saturday's letter, he criticized Obama for not apologizing to the Japanese people during a May trip to Hiroshima. He described Obama's speech there as lacking stature. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.